Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Karen Wyatt, and this panel discussion is on conscious dying, and we would like to be available to answer your questions, but we'll start off with a little discussion first amongst us, and then also take questions from you. So I'm a family practice physician, and maybe we could each introduce ourselves and just talk a little bit. But I'm a family practice doctor, but I've done hospice for a number of years. So do you mind, Kevin?
Hey, my name is Kevin Hazelhorst. I'm an ER doctor from Arizona. I've written the book called Wishes to Die For. And I'm all about, the end of life is sort of considered a medical condition, but I believe it's actually a spiritual journey. And I firmly believe that we need to start talking about advanced care directives, not as medical documents, but more as spiritual initiatives. People are not, my theme is that, we always ask people what their wishes are, but then people never quite know what to answer in response. And so my writing the book was all about giving them the wishes to think about and then putting it in a context of their own, from their own heart as to what's important to them.
I'm Jeff Black. I'm a psychiatrist. I practice mostly dealing with people with PTSD who've dealt a lot with trauma and loss and grief. I'm also on the board of the Living Dying Consciously Project, which deals specifically with a lot of the materials we have and classes that we teach on conscious dying. So,
I am Pim van Lommel, cardiologist from the Netherlands. And for the last 30 years, I've been studying near-death experiences and how the fear of death disappears after having had an NDE. So I've seen many patients who were just relaxed when they died.
Oh, I guess I don't need that. I have my own microphone. I just have to say, this has never happened to me before in my life when I've been sitting in a panel with three other physicians and we're all talking about death and dying and near-death experiences, and we're at an afterlife conference. So it's actually really rare, but it's really heartwarming to me that I'm seeing more and more physicians in medicine who are becoming aware of end-of-life issues and wanting to make a difference and wanting to change the way dying happens in our society. And it's interesting, too, our specialties, because we kind of run the gamut here from cardiology, psychiatry, emergency medicine, and hospice, to get our perspectives. So I thought we could maybe talk, well, I know the subject is conscious dying. Conscious dying could have a lot of different facets, but I thought maybe Kevin, I wanted to ask you at least to talk about something we've discussed before, is the role of doctors in the dying process. And because you're talking about dying more as a spiritual journey than a medical issue. And as an emergency room doctor, I just wanted to know if you would share any of your perspectives or experiences.
I think it's in terms of conversations with patients, you're trying to feel into the situation and trying to give them what they want to hear. So much what we're trained in medical school is you've got to give them hope. And I've come to the awareness that hope is not always the answer that they're looking for. They actually want more peace of mind. And so, realizing where people are, and the thing is, we're called to comfort the dying, and yet we don't even recognize people that are dying. So my own awareness around my writing and understanding is, I have to be able to identify those people that are dying, and to know how to treat them in that moment. And so there are some times where it's life-saving measures are in order. There are some times when comfort measures are in order. There's sometimes when there's a duty to treat, there's sometimes a duty to be empathetic and to be feeling more into the situation. I'm not sure if I'm answering exactly, but because I just sort of ad-lib as I go along. I'll just close right there. I'm mostly open to your questions as to what. And I'd like to hear more about his concept of conscious dying so we can stay a little bit more on message as to where, where he wants to define that, I guess, and then I have a better a template, I guess, to move forward.
Okay, nothing like being on the spot. So. coming from the perspective, I think, of dealing with people who have experienced death in very traumatic ways. I work with active duty military and some veterans, but mostly work in an active duty setting. I think the idea, the concept of dying basically is very different than saying someone who's transitioning and has time, although it's similar enough, I think, to an ER where you have emergency situations where people... It may just seem like it doesn't make sense, or it's an acute situation, and conscious dying for me, I think if you flip the word dying consciously, is becoming more and more aware of what it is that makes you who you are. I think some of the things that I do with people working with their own grief is to be aware of how they're living their life. One of the things I talked about in the workshop I did with Kitty Edwards and Naya Devon was on Thursday was just doing a life review. This may not be answering your question either, but the life review was one of the things that I think if we did that all the time, starting somebody who's 18 and older, teaching them how to do a life review. So when I came home and my wife and I talked about it and we started talking to our kids, both our kids kind of stopped and said, "Are y'all, is there something you're not telling us?" When my parents did it in their, they'll be 80 this year, but right around in their early 70s when I first started talking about this with them and they did it, then I had siblings calling me saying, "Is there something about mom or dad that we don't know?" But I think the... being aware, first and foremost, as a physician, to me, being aware of my own feelings about death and dying. In the shamanic training that I've been through, getting to the point where you don't fear death anymore. I haven't had a near-death experience, but I've had a lot of conversations through journeying with death and sort of seeing what that will be like, so it won't necessarily be a surprise to me when it happens. And I think also helping people do that. But being consciously aware, I do think physicians drop their consciousness at the door when they get into situations with death and dying because it's such a fearful thing for so many people. In our culture in general, we will entertain ourselves away from talking about anything that's fearful or ugly. Even though a lot of things that we watch are all about death and destruction and dying and, you know, just look at video games. So I think for me, the experience of being a part of helping people work through both their stages of grief, the horror from the trauma they experienced and the loss of their friend, part of what I end up doing is helping them come to terms with their own life, how they want to live their life. And these are, you know, 19 to 26-year-olds usually. So,
Pim, would you answer the question about how you would define conscious dying?
Oh, I didn't do that,
Dennis. And being from the Netherlands, are there differences that you see?
Well, I think the most important thing that I can agree is that there's a huge lot of fear about death and dying in our society. And it's a huge taboo still, also in the medical education, also for the most physicians. And the moment you are confronted with the death of a dear one, then most people start to think about it, which is also the case for physicians as well. Mm-hmm. It's not about the patients who die. It's about a close relative who is dying. And you start thinking about it. In cardiology, most people who die is an acute death, where you have a CPR, cardiac arrest, CPR, and you don't succeed to get the patients back, and then the problem is with the family.
Mm-hmm.
But when they survive the cardiac arrest, and we did a study about people who survive cardiac arrest, and 80% reported a near-death experience. And one of the main things that changes is that the loss of the fear of death. Mm-hmm. Because death was not death at all. It was another form of life. So they lose the fear of death. And I remember one patient who had a cardiac arrest 5 years before due to a huge myocardial infarction, and he had a near-death experience. And 5 years later, he was admitted in the hospital in the cardiac ward because of end stage of heart failure. And mostly, when people are dying in the room, doctors and nurses are trying to evade the room, and family members are very uncomfortable about it. But this patient, the door was open, and everybody would love to enter his room in the last days of his life. Doctors came in, nurses came in, family members, other patients came in, because he was so happy and relaxed and could talk to everybody that death was not the end. So that was so striking for us that he really could help others because of his own near-death experience.
And
that was, for me, conscious dying.
Yes.
It's much more than just the end, but the insight that it's not the end is
yes,
so important.
So important. And I wanted to say, I feel working in hospice, we have almost the luxury of working with patients who are going through a more gradual dying process and have the chance to even become more conscious and reach a point like your patient you're describing of peace within themselves, which then emanates to the family members and to all the staff members working with them, which is how hospice workers can do hospice, because they receive so much peace and blessing from the patients who become more conscious of dying and lose their fear at the end of life. But you're seeing patients in the emergency room who die suddenly and unexpectedly, families who are traumatized, and then you're seeing the survivors of great trauma also. So you're dealing with that end of the spectrum. This is a theory I have that I wanted to ask you three doctors what you think. I think a lot of doctors are actually experiencing some PTSD. And I state just my own experience from medical training. The first time I saw a patient die, a 16-year-old girl in the emergency room who was in a car accident. And I'd never seen anyone die, let alone someone under my hands that I was doing CPR on. And no one was there to help me process that or understand what death was. Or I saw her family grieving. I saw the blank faces on the doctors and the nurses who'd been in the room with us, and they just walked away and went on to see other patients. So that event was traumatic for me. And I'm curious to know if you feel, I've seen it with other doctors that I believe have been traumatized somewhat by their own experiences with death that have not been processed. I'm just curious if you have any sense of that, if you've seen it.
From a strange point of view, I don't necessarily see the wrong in that person who is at peace. And I look, sometimes their eyes are wide, pupils are dilated, and I see, my God, what they must see in that afterworld. It must be very striking, because they give me that image of something that is glorious and wonderful. But the calmness that occurs after the storm is something that I really feel happy for them in some respects, that they've completed their journey. And maybe, I can't remember. I think because in terms of how I cope with it or manage it, I see it in more of a positive light than necessarily a negative light. And even the child who was burned, 2 years old, there's still something very beautiful about that body that I didn't necessarily see. In its horror, I still see a sense of peace and almost like a doll-like image. And maybe I just whitewash it to the extent that I look for something positive in that experience. And it's part of what I have to do, I presume, in coping, is to be able to process it in a way that brings peace and comfort to this existence. That for whatever reason happened, it happened for a reason, and there was peace in the end, is how I see it.
I think that's beautiful that you're able to do that. There's no but to this, but it's going to sound like a but. I think that I had similar experiences Karen had in medical school. A two-year-old brought into the emergency room who had sudden infant, not really infant, but sudden death. And they had done everything, and she was dead. And all the ER physician, nothing against ER physicians, but all this ER physician wanted me to do was learn how to intubate a child. And I just said, I'm not doing it, you know. And so she got kind of mad at me. Or the first person that I remember, it's interesting because I remember the first person that died while I was doing CPR, and just stopping and everybody kind of saying, oh, well. And then we went to the next room and started doing things and then just sort of left it. We left it to somebody else. And you can really get off on, I think, being really upset with physicians and thinking that we're horrible people because we just don't know how to handle death. But we're not. I hear that people more and more in medical schools are talking about it a little. I have heard people say that part of the training in medical school is to be able to talk about life and preservation of life and doing life heroic measures. But it's all done in a sense of wait until something manifests. Wait until something happens before we address it. And I think one of the things, you know, I had one little tangent. I had 1 hour of nutrition. That was it. Not a 1 hour class, not a 1 hour class in a semester. I had literally 1 hour done by this kyphotic woman who smoked cigarettes while she walked in and had this.
Let me tell you about nutrition. So,
But with that, we had little to no experiences. The experiences I had with physicians who had a conscious dying approach, understanding that sometimes you have to be prepared, sometimes you have to prepare families. I remember Andy Albritton had a patient had leukemia, had an acute onset. Andy came and said, I need you to talk to the family. I'm going to go there with you, but I think this is a good experience for you. I need you to talk to the family because he is not going to live. And I'm a junior medical student. I'm a third-year medical student. But we sat with him. He talked with them. He answered all their questions. Then we went in and we talked to the patient, and I said, you know, I'm supposed to come in and talk to you about death and dying. And he goes, okay. And I said, I don't know what to say. And he said, well, I don't either, but you're not the one dying. I am. And so he said, so why don't we have a conversation about death and dying? And so that was probably one of the teachable moments for me. I talked to other people. They didn't have training like that. Maybe the universe really wanted me to make sure I had some of those experiences, but didn't have training. And I do think that if we look at medical school and we look at how we treat people as individuals and with a sense of balance, then death makes sense as part of the transition, and it can enter in the conversation without it being fearful. But as Karen will probably say in just a minute, you start bringing that up to a bunch of doctors about how you need to learn how to help people with conscious dying. It's not backpedaling. It's the door shutting, and they're running out the door, and some of them.
I think time is changing as well. My father was a doctor physician, and my mother was dying of end stage of cancer, breast cancer, when I was 31. And we couldn't discuss death with my mother, and we had a discussion with our brothers and sisters with my father, and he said to us, "Don't mention death to her." Hmm. It was awful, but I think the time has changed as well. I lecture quite a lot for medical students, medical schools, hospitals, hospices, physicians about near death experiences, just to explain what death could be. And I think that's a very important thing. Another thing which is important, this is my experience, and in hospice workers, volunteers, a lot of them have had a near-death experience, and that is why they are volunteering. Mm-hmm. So they are helping the people because they have their own experience themselves, and they help people for conscious dying. But I agree that for a lot of physicians, they are not able to help people for conscious dying. But I'm positive it's changing, and I'm very positive about the younger generation.
Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I've been hearing about and seeing is that a lot of medical schools are now incorporating rotations on death and dying, maybe brief, maybe hopefully more than 1 hour, and hopefully not the lady who smokes teaching it. But I do think a problem is the faculty for medical students are older doctors who themselves haven't been trained. And so how do you train someone in something that you yourself haven't been trained to do? But that will change. That will change. And just the fact that some of us, without having been trained, have become conscious of dying and are helping our patients with death and dying. It's a rising in consciousness in our society in general. So I believe that more and more doctors will be waking up and will be paying attention to dying. I wanted to ask right away if there are any questions from the audience. Yes.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nadine Drysdale from Vancouver, and my concern is that even though curriculums in the medical schools now talk about death and dying, it seems to be, you know, what did Elizabeth Kubler Ross teach us? And okay, now let's talk about advanced directives. But there seems to be an avoidance of talking about near-death experiences per se. And in fact, what the medical school where I teach residents, I recently taught the palliative care fellows, and nobody had even mentioned near-death experiences to them. They didn't know what they were, and they're palliative care physicians.
Interesting. And that's a great comment. And I've been told that if you were to ask nurses in the hospital, many of them have had near-death experiences, and William Peters would say, or shared death experiences with patients, and probably doctors too, who are hiding it because they have no idea. Everyone will think I'm crazy if I talked about that. And I think it's still because those experiences are beyond the rational science that we deal with. It's a little scary to be the person who comes forward and talks about it. But
I'm wondering if maybe the approach is to just make it really matter of fact. 18% of people that survive cardiac arrests have these experiences. And what we know is that it's peaceful at that time. Now, you might think that implies a spiritual implication, and we can talk about that if you like or not, but it's interesting that people have these phenomena. Mm-hmm. Because doctors are interested in phenomena and syndromes. They're not interested in the spiritual ramifications.
Yeah, I was curious, Pim, do you have experience with doctors, teaching doctors?
Well, first thing is nurses are much better than doctors. They can listen, and they take the time. Doctors say, I have no time, but you can make time always. And it's fear. They keep the door closed because the worldview will collapse if they really listen with their heart. So we have to learn to listen with our heart. I receive invitation from medical students to come to talk to them, 300, 400 people from all universities in Holland, because they know my book. And they know about it. And it's also the same a little bit in Germany. So they are far more open. And what Max Planck ever has said, that a new scientific truth will just be accepted as the old generation has died. And the younger generation will accept it as normal. And I think that is what's happening now already. So I feel compassionate for all those physicians who are not able to listen. Mm-hmm. And I feel compassion for the patients who are not able to share their intimate feelings and near-death experience with others and with their physicians. So, but I'm very positive. It will change.
My name's Gary, and I teach in School of Medicine and the School of Allied Health at St. Louis University. And my observation, having taught for 25 years, is until we address the silo education where physicians get trained here, nurses get trained here, chaplains get trained here. So what we're doing at St. Louis University is we have an interdisciplinary beginning of an interdisciplinary approach, so that the silo mentality, this is what a doctor does and what they're good at, this is what, so there's a lack of respect and understanding for the role of the chaplain when it comes to dying, the role of the physician, the role of the nurse. And I think the hospice model that Karen spoke so eloquently at our conference 3 years ago at St. Louis University, how the hospice model, I'll use the word needs, to be brought into the healthcare model, that how we practice hospice medicine is ideal for how we need to begin practicing the general medical healthcare, that the chaplain has a role, and everybody's listened to, you know, the nurse is listened to for her his expertise, and et cetera. In the physician assistance program that I teach an ethics course, and I teach psychosocial spiritual assessment for the PA, because the PA is becoming the gatekeeper. They're the first physician assistant in many medical practices are becoming the first person to see the patient. So I had this honor and privilege of teaching them a psycho, an emotional, social, and spiritual approach to their assessments. And I'm writing, I surveyed PA students, and I've got enough qualitative data for a publishable paper, I think, because the feedback from these PAs is, oh my God, this is so refreshing from the empirical education. Everything's empirical. Everything's empirical throughout med school. And to have this course sort of, and I've yet to have a PA student say, this is stupid. Why are we taking a psychosocial spiritual approach to assessment? Everyone is unanimously positive. The last thing, I got a $200,000 grant to survey pediatricians about this issue. Overwhelmingly, the pediatricians in St. Louis were saying, help us. We want to learn the language. We didn't get it in med school, and we're faced with adolescents who are depressed in spiritual crisis, and we don't know what to do with them. And most pediatricians don't hire chaplains, social workers in their practice. And that has to change also. You know, having mental health care workers in the clinics with the physicians is absolutely essential, because it's unfair for physicians to be all to every person that comes through the door. So there is a study going on at St. Louis University, a control study with pediatricians who have social workers hired full-time in the clinic, and those that don't, and they're looking at recidivism. Because Dr. Hazelars can tell you that so many return visits to the ER are mental health crisis that brings them back to the emergency room.
And I'm wondering if, Jeff and Kevin, do you have any thoughts about, do you see any inroads through your specialty or where you work in terms of talking to other physicians about end-of-life issues or near-death experiences? Do you see that?
I'm fascinated by the fact that I've, people know about my work and my interest, and I'm sort of overlooked. They know I'm looking over their shoulder when they admit a patient to the intensive care unit that we should have called hospice on. And many times the nurses will come get me for a person that they feel would benefit from, our family that would benefit from my conversation or listening, to try to help them, you know, deal with this person from the nursing home that's, you know, we're not moving anything forward here. So, but I do know the challenges, and I can actually say within my own family, when my father passed away last week, it was the same conversation about why are we giving him antibiotics if it's his time to die, and it's the same conversation I have with caregivers and family members in the emergency room about their struggles about withholding or withdrawing certain medications from a patient when it's clearly the end of, we're providing end of life care. So why are we prolonging their life if the intention is to I guess if you're talking about quality of death, you're basically hastening their death instead of prolonging their life. You can't have one without the other. And in terms of distinguishing how you're treating that person in the moment, we got to be accepting that, you know, there's a time to live and there's a time to die. How we treat people when it's time to die is yet to be recognized. There is no standardization around how we do this. We have institute or, you know, hospice care, but I can tell you hospice is very conflicted in what they, what, you know, it's only as good as what the family allows hospice to be. It's still left up to their discretion as to what they, their, what they're willing to let go of in different stages. And I'm very clear, you know, many of these forms of hospice are actually palliative care, that there's a bridge between advanced care and end-of-life care, and I call it palliative care. It's when you allow people free choice, either receive intervention or to receive medical care. And I often say, you know, I stand on one side of the stretcher, I offer everything the medical system has to offer. Is there anybody on the other side of the stretcher that says it's okay for you not to accept any of what I have to offer, but still be cared for? And that's where a palliative provider or a nurse practitioner or someone like that would be able to help the caregiver feel good about taking that person home without feeling negligent or that they haven't done enough. So I just think there's more work to be had in terms of creating an overall understanding of what we do for people at the end of life and how they are to be treated and to be respected. Right now it's like people don't feel like they're respected unless we're doing everything. Dignity means we do everything for that person. We save their life. We have not cut them off from what's necessary when we, or we haven't decided that this is what's medically necessary, is we do things to people. I can tell you the medical field is not clear about this either in terms of, you know, what we mean by this as we say it, because again, one person receiving this type of hospice care could be a different experience, because they come into the emergency room and they're on hospice care and they're receiving advanced care. And I'm like, I don't understand how, I don't know how to treat these people. And in some respects, I fault hospice for not being more clear about it. And they're offering people more of what they want. You know, we want to always defer to the autonomy of the patient, but sometimes they're making unwise choices. And they end up in the emergency room with a broken hip. Well, they're not a surgical candidate. They haven't been a surgical candidate for 5 or 6 years. And now they're coming in there in the hospital for a hip replacement, and they're on hospice. So there's a big confusion around people in the industry who are not being upfront about what we can and what we can't do. So, go ahead.
And I find that too with the near-death experience. I mean, how many have you brought back to life, and did you ask them, did you have a near-death experience? Are you allowed to even ask that? I mean, those kind of code words, you can't even get out there, you know? Nobody can bring up the topics because of the words and the language.
Well, I ask patients. That's how it started. Nurses ask better. And because of, in the Netherlands, the study had been done, it is well known, so more and more even cardiologists are calling me. I had a patient now, and can you talk with him or her? But there is still a taboo and also a lot of ignorance. And for physicians, I presume it's mostly willful ignorance. They don't want to know. That's also what you said. I had once a lecture for 120 physicians talking about the death experience, and then I asked who had, and there were 7 of them who had a near-death experience, and they have never talked about it to their colleagues, never. Mm-hmm. And I know physicians who had a near-death experience, and they told me, said, what happened to me now, I've ever always said, this is impossible, and now it happened to me. So you have to be open, and you have to listen to others, and then you can accept it. But in the current medical society, it's still a problem. About hospice and dying, in Holland, it's very popular to give birth to babies at home and to die at home as mm-hmm. well. More and more people with a 24-hour service, mostly also by volunteers. So people don't want to go to a hospice, but to die at home consciously.
Yes, that's beautiful. Yeah. I'm curious, just Jeff, about psychiatry and near-death experiences,
Well, I haven't had experiences with talking to people about near-death experiences except for... except for when I finally went to the Department of Defense and I started working with active duty, then there were a lot of people who now tell me how not only did they have an experience where they separated and they saw themselves, or they had an experience of going and meeting other people and having a near-death experience, but they also had the experience of their own individual process of, and not to take this into a different direction, but just the whole soul loss. They would have the pieces of themselves sort of split off, so it's sort of the other end of it. But yes, I think a lot of people will say that to me, but then they always wait and see whether I'm gonna call somebody to come pick them up. The other thing I was gonna say just about the inroads, I understand going to medical school, and I understand what it took to get there, and I understand in our culture people looking up to and needing to respect. Maybe I hear some professional medical colleagues talk about how people don't respect doctors like they used to, and that's a wholly different conversation. But one of the things, you know, my grandmother's generation, the doctor told her to do something, she just did it. She just never asked a question. My mom's a little bit like that. She has Parkinson's, and so now she's a little bit better about making a list. She has a notebook. She has all her medications. She always makes the doctor a list of what she's taking when she takes it. My dad helps her with that. And so one of the things I would say is just thinking about inroads, that we could certainly start from the top down. And I'm doing top and bottom, not that patients are at the bottom and doctors are at the top, although that's kind of how doctors feel it is. But but if you talk about one place or the other, that we could certainly, and I think it certainly needs to be in medical school education, and there's a desperate need for that, and there's a desperate need in practice. But I think one of the ways to make inroads, if you think about the way things have happened with integrative care, we're looking at more holistic care. Some physicians will just tell you to go somewhere else, they're not going to see you anymore. But more and more and more people are saying to their physicians, well, what else can I do? And forever and ever, complementary medicine has been an and or. You know, if you're going to do complementary medicine, then you're not going to do allopathic medicine. And now it's beginning to be more of an and. And I think it's the same way. So I would challenge each of you to take responsibility for this, not just expecting us doctors to take responsibility for this, to demand that your patient. I used to have to do, this is going to be an inappropriate word here, but I used to have to do what were coined by nurses as asshole consults. And that was where I would have to go into a situation where a patient was refusing care. They weren't necessarily dying, but they were refusing care, and the doctor would say, this person's crazy, come certify them so I can cut their leg off. And that was one of them. And all the patient wanted was the doctor to come in, sit down, talk to me like a person. And when you talk to me, then help me understand what you're going to do, and then give me the good news or give me the bad news. And in doing that, it opened up this whole process to where the nurses would finally tell doctors, do you need Dr. Black to come over and help you learn how to talk to this patient? And they would normally end up doing it. But I really, the more people can demand this from their physicians, talk to me, tell me about this. And then it brings up within each individual one of you, what are my fears about death? Am I conscious about my dying? Am I living my life with a sense of regret and holding on to things? How is my life going to be at the very end? How do I want my funeral to be? It's weird. I'm having that conversation with my kids, are 21 and 24, and they were like, hey, do we have to talk about this right now? And I'm like, yes, we do have to talk about this right now. And then I'm going to ask you what you want at your funeral. And they're like, oh, God. But it was this cool experience. More and more, I think, educating, doing conferences like this, but you demand that your doctor sit down and talk to me, or stop and talk to me. Ask questions. Have a list. You know, and when the doctor talks, take notes. If you can't take notes, and or if somebody that's going can't take notes, take somebody with them. My mom can't write very well. Well, she says I write, but it's all over the place because of her Parkinson's. But she, my dad writes for her, or she records it on her phone. She finally figured out how to use her smartphone. And by doing that, she's requiring, I mean, when the doctor knows she's coming, the doctor's up to, he knows everything that's going on. He gets her chart. Miss Black's coming. Y'all better get the chart ready. And doing something like that is, it's your responsibility as well to decide how you want to live your life, but also how you want to die. And it isn't, if you ever go to a doctor and the doctor says, this is just, you just have to do this, and they want to explain it to you, I'd get up and leave and fire them.
I just want to follow up one statement. You know, the number one question you want to ask your doctor, is this medically necessary? That opens the door to me sitting down and saying, you're right. I'm following a protocol. I'm doing what everybody expects me to do. But if you're going to take me, if you're going to allow me to be real with you, then I'm going to sit down and be real with you. If you have a certain expectation of me, then I'm just going to play the role. I'm going to play what you expect me to be. But until you take the lead and say, is this medically necessary? That's the person at the end of life who would really say, really, is it medically necessary that I be resuscitated? It changes the whole dynamic as soon as you throw those words out there. Yes. It gives an empowerment to you saying, I don't have to take this. I don't want to just you run me through the mill and then come up with, no, I can tell you I'm going to run all these tests and they're going to be negative. So no, we don't have to do these tests. I can sit down and tell you what's going on and just bottom line the whole thing. And if you can check out. If it doesn't feel right, we'll relook at the conversation. But we've had the conversation up front. We didn't come back after you've ran all those tests and say, I didn't expect to find anything anyway. People feel like they were given a disservice. But again, if you don't ask for it, you're not going to get it.
What about the going beyond the directive? More and more we hear people have written their directive, but then they disregard the directive and go ahead and do all those tests.
Well, what are you showing up in the emergency room if your directive is not to, you know, if most people who have some intention in calling 911 or haven't really communicated what those directives mean, patients will come in and say, I don't know if I'm to be resuscitated. You have them in the records. What do you mean you don't know what your directives are? And so in some respect, you know, these directives are kind of a smokescreen in terms of what really we want people to be able to make their decisions in the moment. And the directives don't really tell us how to make the decisions. They simply tell you, if you're in a coma, I don't want a feeding tube. But how do you know you don't want a feeding tube if you haven't thought through the other, you know, quality of life issues, where the crystal ball is going to lead you in terms of, is that feeding tube really going to be, is it medically necessary? Is it going to change my outcome by having that feeding tube?
I know you in the back, she's been raising her hand.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question. When the first heart transplant was done in 1976 in South Africa, the discussion was there, how do we get organs to transplant? And in 1968, the ad hoc committee in Harvard with ethics and surgeons came to the conclusion that someone in a long-term coma, a coma dépassé, they called it at that time, we call them brain dead. And we call brain dead, and then we have organs from dead people. So it is a construct about what that should be. Yeah. And the diagnosis of brain dead is different for different countries. In the UK, it's brain stem death. In most countries, it's a total brain death. But the diagnosis is sometimes very, very difficult because the circulation can be minimal, but so there is no function of the brain, but the brain is not dead. Ischemic penumbra, it is called. It's a kind of stunning of the brain. But when the diagnosis is well done, then 3% of the body is irreversibly damaged, and 97% of the body is alive and is kept alive. But the law writes about the artificial respiration of a corpse. where we know it's impossible. There are more than 10 women who had been declared brain dead, but they were pregnant. They were put on the machine for weeks until they gave birth to a living child. A corpse cannot give birth to a living child. So brain death is not death. Brain death is the start of a process of dying, but can take hours to days. And when you take out living organs out of a patient who is in the dying process, you will enhance the process of dying. And we don't know exactly what's happening to the consciousness of this dying patients when your heart and lungs and liver is taken out. But in my concept, when the body, the brain and the body, and each cell is the interface function for our consciousness, and you transplant living organs into another person, then this organ has still the interface function for the consciousness of the diseased person. And that is why we have stories about The Change of Heart is one of the most famous books. Mm-hmm. And the United States, it's possible after 4 years to know the identity of the donor. In Holland, it's not possible to know the donor. And we have tried to do studies about it. And transplant centers don't want to do any study about this because they are afraid. And I have given lectures about it also in Germany about brain death. It's not death. And the transplant centers are very, very aggressive about it because they say more people will die on the waiting list. But that's not the discussion. Discussion is brain death is not death. And there is also in the United States and also in Germany are a lot of physicians who write articles about it. It's not death at all. It's a construct. And when we realize that our body and our consciousness is related to each other, also during the dying process, well, that has a huge impact in when you die.
It's true. There was just a survey released in April by the Hancock Foundation that showed that since those codes went into effect January this year, and since that time, only 14% of the physicians they've surveyed have done any advanced care planning with patients or used the codes. And most of them said the reason they haven't done it is because they haven't been trained and they don't know what to say. And so that's going to be our next issue because they used to say, I don't get paid to have that conversation, and now they can't say that anymore.
Are you telling me that a physician can have a conversation with an 18-year-old and the 18-year-old does not want to be resuscitated, that that's to be honored?
I'm talking about having the conversation of, you know, have you thought about this? I'm not talking about when they're
I think, again, what I heard was, you know, we're filling out these forms and we're trying to make sense of them. And then, again, when we fill out these forms that don't make sense to people, then we're stuck with forms that don't necessarily, you know, equate to the situation. You know, I think these directives have to be fluid because there's no way that you can anticipate everything that could transpire in the next 10 years, and your wishes could certainly change. And, you know, again, they will pay for repeated conversations along this line, but I think it's a little bit, it's all well and good that you talk with your doctor, but you really need to talk with yourself first and have a real heart-to-heart conversation, what your priorities are, where your finish line is, where you would start withdrawing or withholding care. It isn't, you know, you have to know that internally before your doctor is ever going to, before you're looking for the doctor to tell you how to process that.
Well, and I've heard stories that you can have those conversations with your family and then they don't support you. So
of course, yeah.
There's so much education that needs to happen.
I appreciate you. Well, you're so right that if we're on talking about honoring patients' wishes, we have to honor all patients' wishes, whatever they are. And I read a statistic that about 37% of patients who do complete advanced directives want some sort of treatment at the end of life. And so they're using the advance directive to indicate that they do want some intervention done at the end of life. And that's perfect. I mean, that is exactly what it should be used for, is for patients to be able to express what they want.
What about the patient who's on hospice who wants to be a full code?
Well, I think it can't be because of hospice regulations, and the patient can't be on hospice unless they agree. They can be on palliative care and be, yeah. Well, maybe I can do my best to explain it, that hospice care is defined primarily by how it's paid for, to be honest. It's paid for by Medicare, and the Medicare regulation state, it's for the last 6 months of life. So a person has to have a terminal diagnosis, and a doctor has to certify that this patient has 6 months or less to live, and that's when they're qualified for the hospice benefit. But they have to stop any curative treatments that are being received, because Medicare won't pay for both, because it's, you know, paying to keep you comfortable and paying for a curative treatment. So hospice is comfort care at the end of life with 6 months or less to live. When curative care has been stopped and the patient agrees, they don't want to be resuscitated. So it is primarily end-of-life care. Palliative care is much broader and bigger than hospice care. It can be started at any point during the patient's disease, and it can be offered alongside curative care. So there's no requirement for the patient to stop curative care. Palliative care, like hospice, is multidisciplinary, so there's a team of people that help care for the patient, and it emphasizes comfort. While the patient's getting, maybe it's a patient with cancer who's getting chemotherapy, hasn't reached that 6 month point. No one knows at this point if the chemotherapy will work. The patient can receive palliative care, which ideally meets their psychosocial spiritual needs and their comfort needs, and helps them with pain management, and helps them make sure they're treated with dignity and comfortable. And the idea behind palliative care is that those specialists, at some point along the road, if they feel this patient is now, these curative treatments are no longer working, this patient is now ready for hospice care, that they help ease the patient into hospice care, which is still offering all the comfort care and the psychosocial spiritual support. They're paid for differently. That's why we differentiate. And Medicare has set that 6 month deadline. Go ahead. No, no. They can be recertified for, yeah. They can be recertified for a longer period of time. It's only that the doctor has to state when they're admitted that the doctor feels the patient has 6 months or less to live. Yeah, many patients stay on longer than the 6 months, so it isn't they're not forced to leave hospice care. But it's a little tricky because sometimes it's hard to say when a patient is 6 months from death. It's tough for doctors to give that prognosis at times.
I heard that there were a couple programs that they were going to put into certain hospices to see if they can keep on curative care and hospice.
Yes.
So there's a little shift,
and they're doing a pilot study to offer hospice care to patients who are still getting curative treatments to see how that works. I think it's, again, a financial issue, because when a patient's on hospice, Medicare pays every day a certain amount per day to the hospice for care for that patient. And the hospice pays for anything the patient needs while they're under hospice care out of that per diem that they receive. Whereas palliative care, it's fee for service. The palliative care program bills Medicare for whatever care they offer. So many insurances will pay for palliative and hospice. So it's different payment models, which makes it more complicated for the hospice and palliative care unit to figure out how are we going to get enough money to take care of this patient, and what's the best way to offer care. That's part of the mess that we're in with Medicare, in a way, offering end-of-life care. But that's where we are right now. So it's why we have two different types of care, even though it's very similar care the patient's receiving. They're paid for differently, and the criteria are a little different.
But they are finding people who have palliative care
Yes, people with palliative care live longer, and people with hospice care live longer. And so it all makes sense, which was in the talk that Gary was referring to. I was saying this is what all medical care should be like. It should all be provided by a team of people. And
I was just going to say, first of all, the top and the bottom is how it's usually been. That's not how I personally feel. I'm perfectly fine with other people. If they earned a doctorate, call themselves doctor. I have no problem with that. I don't introduce myself as Dr. Black. I have a friend whose dad introduced himself even, you know, in social situations as Dr. Smith, we'll call him. But I think that points back to what you said about medical necessity and about being educated and about educating your doctor. I think that's part of what conscious dying is all about. How do you want your end of life to be? And if you're not even having the conversation, first of all, with yourself, and you're not having the conversation with people who love you and care about you, how in the world are you going to expect a physician to have any kind of a conversation? And why in the world is it up to me to start that conversation? I could, and a lot of times when you start that conversation, it's like, what? Like my kids, why are we doing this kind of thing? So I think if you wanted to go to a physical therapist, if you wanted to go, I will probably not have a conversation. I don't personally like going to doctors, so... But I want to be able to go to a doctor in an emergency room if I have an acute trauma, if I have something that happens, but I want my family to be very aware of everything that I want. If I have a good relationship with somebody within a mental health or medical team, I think that's why medical home models, patient centered care, we keep coming up with new names for things like putting lipstick on a pig, but really and truly, if we start being serious about that kind of stuff and we really are pulling everybody together, that's going to make a huge, huge difference. Because I may have a great – my mom doesn't enjoy talking to the neurologist. She loves the nurse practitioner, absolutely loves. And she'll talk to the neurologist, but she's usually like, you know, I already said all this. But – she will be probably talking to, and the nurse practitioner has talked to her about death and dying and how she wants things to be at the end of life. And that'll be the person that she talks to. Somebody else, it might be the nurse. It might be, so I don't see that that's a problem. And I feel really good about earning an MD, but I don't have to show it. I've got copy of my diploma on my phone because I had to give it to somebody, but I could show it, you know.
I was going to just add briefly, hospice, the model for hospice is a team approach with doctor, nurse, home health aide, volunteer, chaplain, social worker, this team, that interdisciplinary team that meets usually every other week to discuss patients. But very often I found the volunteer would be the person the patient related to the most. The volunteer was one of the most valuable team members who would come in with all these stories and tell us all this information they'd heard, because they'd spend hours with the patient. They go visit and they'd, you know, bring French fries and sit and eat French fries and talk. And so the volunteers were one of my most valuable allies when I needed to know, is Mr. Jones actually having pain and not telling us about it? Because they would see what happened when the nurse wasn't there and when no one else was paying attention. And so that model for me, it's ideal because we're bringing the talents together of many different people who have different perspectives on what's happening. And it's ideal. And again, we're not expecting a doctor to have all the tools. We're creating a team, and between all the team members, we have most of the tools. But
yeah. Well, I think that's an important part about, you know, patients don't always feel comfortable talking to the doctor about these things, and so the home health aide who comes in, or the home health nurse who comes into those environments, and they're sitting down and just having a, you know, overall conversation. They're befriending the person. They're getting some, you know, what they're struggling with and what they're what their concerns are. It's like, that's when you want to capitalize on, well, how do we get that known to everybody else around you? They're sort of getting the message, and then how do we, you know, if they don't want to go back to the hospital again, how do we make sure that they're set up so they don't have, they can call the palliative nurse instead of the 911 kind of thing? So I think it's really the ground people, what did they call them? Something like that. Yeah, those people that are in the trenches who are really sitting with the patients who can really access what's important to them and then try to match their wishes into how they position themselves in their directives or their care plans so we're all on board. So a patient isn't drugged into the emergency room at a last-ditch effort for some ungodly reason, and not really, no one ever thought there was any benefit to that happening. But I do think it's the people that are spending the most time. It's not the physician's role.
I was going to say, one of the things with that, though, is in the shamanic tradition I was trained in, you don't do anything with anyone without their permission. And if you can't gain permission, you don't do anything. And so I think that's also, if you think about it, that's also one of the things that we need to be remembering with people when we're talking to them. The whole idea of doing something to somebody and not knowing whether it's really what they want, do we really have their permission? And that's where communicating is so important, and the whole idea of medical necessity, things like that. So I do think it just has to be done with the utmost integrity and with a person's permission. But that's why it's so important to let people know what it is that you want, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'll just briefly say that I think that you're right, Olivia, and one thing I see as an issue that it's happening in hospitals, it's happening throughout corporatized medicine, is that nurses are being given, you know, pain scales, and you have to assess the patient's pain and where are they on a scale of 1 to 10, and you have to document it and you have to show that you did something to help with the pain. And so it's medicine by numbers, where people are being told, well, you said your patient, this happened to me because I was in the hospital with a concussion and a broken collarbone. And the nurses came in and said, what's your pain level? And I said, 7. And they said, then we're giving you pain meds. And I said, no, you're not. I have a head injury. You can't give me pain meds. But they came back every hour until finally I got it. Don't say 7. So I said, oh, it's 3. It's 3. I'm fine. And then they left me alone. But I realized it's the number is what matters, and it dictates. If the patient's not awake and conscious, they have a little chart they look at that shows the facial expressions to decide what degree of pain the patient's having. And it's an issue everywhere in the hospital, but I think I'm sure it's affecting hospices too, where the numbers are being calculated. People are looking at the numbers to make sure we're doing a good enough job taking care of pain, but the subtleties of it are being missed. But sorry, Pim, go ahead.
My answer can be short. There was, in our study, no difference for people with a lot of medication, complicated CPR, 3 weeks in coma, didn't matter at all. If the percentage of near-death experiences. So a lot of medication or without any medication didn't matter at all.
I personally use the patient's family as my guide. If they feel like they're restless, again, I have a very short duration with patients, but I do use the family's comfort in comforting them as well, so they have control over the situation, and that's how it works. But I, with my father passing, he was on a schedule for his medication, and the family, I think, was comfortable, and there was a point where he got a little bit more, I think, as he got more agitated. And it's very hard to know exactly how to treat people. And I appreciate your work. I really do. I think you, because you work from an intuitive hand, and it's such a beautiful experience, I think, to gift that you give to somebody. And I just certainly, I wouldn't want medicine to cloud some of that experience that you offer patients.
Thank you.
But I think that's a rare person who gets to die in your hands, though. Same time, I always go back to this idea that sometimes we have to induce labor when the mother is struggling to deliver her child, and for the child's safety, at some point you do have to intervene. And so in the end-of-life transition, I would call it induced tranquility. I'm perfectly comfortable with allowing medication to be administered to those patients. I don't think they necessarily need to feel the extent of the birthing process. I think it can be just as fulfilling without experiencing the pain necessarily. I think that's what we, you know, I used to set, you know, we used to fix dislocated shoulders without sedation. We used to have children screaming when we were realigning their bones because we weren't allowed to give them anesthesia. That to me is unconscionable. And yet, I think you're suggesting the same thing. We should feel every bit of that pain, and I don't think that's reasonable.
I think that we're out of time, the time allotted to us, but it seems like we're having a great discussion. But I wanted to make sure that anyone, what's going on after this? I have no idea. I'm lost. Dinner's next? Because I don't want to... Oh, cocktails. Oh, well, that's a different story then. Let's go. Cocktails. But thank you. Thank you all. Thanks for the wonderful questions and comments. It was a really great discussion.